So tonight we chose the topic of tzedakah, the mitzvah of giving charity.
Okay.
He writes the following.
Oh, tell me, who is he?
This is the Peleoid. So every Tuesday night at this hour we meet, Ora comes, and sometimes Larry comes, and we study Peleoid. He was a great rabbi about two centuries ago.
Okay.
This is what the book looks like, and the pages in Hebrew I have photocopied here. There is an English translation, but I don't have access to it. He asks the question, Stakad Heichan Kocha, how great is the power of charity? And we'll see as we go along what he means by that question. Mi Amalel means who could sing the praises, meaning it's endless, it's infinite. And he writes that there was a book authored on the subject of charity, Tzedakah, Mi'il Tzedakah, and it was authored by the same author of another famous work called Shevet Musar. And in this book, he organizes and gathers together all the statements of our rabbis in the Shas, in the Midrash, all the statements that speak about the greatness of charity. And he says the following, Lefi Gadla V'tuva, he says, because of its greatness, Yitzro Shel Adam is Gavrolov, means that's why it becomes such a challenging mitzvah. So what he's suggesting is that the greater the mitzvah on that scale, the greater the challenge is to fulfill the mitzvah. And he says the following, Maksha Libo, the barriers or the inhibitions strengthen his heart, meaning make him a little bit callous and unsensitive, so that he won't fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah the way he should fulfill it. The Al-Kagon said, and therefore the Gemara describes this as Adam Nikar Bekiso. He says man can be identified, and if you want to evaluate a person, you can evaluate it by his pocketbook, how much he spends for charity. He says, Ki Yetzer, the power, the inclination of Chibas HaMamon, the love for money, he says, Rav Ma'od, is very powerful. In other words, man by his very nature loves money. He wants to possess more and more, so it's very hard for him to part with his money. Ashrei HaMizgaber Olav Midei Yom Yom V'Nitzol Mimenu. How fortunate, how wonderful, what merits there are for a person who's able to overcome that tendency on a daily basis, and he's be able to give out his money for charity, for the poor. Ma Rav Tuvo Uma Tov Chelko Uma Noim Gorolo. He says that you can't even evaluate how great his merit is, his portion in the world to come, and in the world that we have today, Ba'olam Hazeh and Ba'olam Abba. How are you? So Raz, this is the Hebrew version. And
you, what?
This is the Hebrew text that we're doing tonight.
Thank you.
You have an English version?
Yeah, I'm going to pick it up.
It would be good. Okay, I don't know if we have time now, but if we had time, I would photocopy the English pages that correspond to this.
Oh, I see.
All right, but in the meantime, we'll try to do the best we can to
understand.
To translate.
Here's a question. This might be a question. You say tzedakah and you say charity.
Right.
But it doesn't mean the same thing.
Well, the truth is, I think we'll be able to answer your question after we get the whole picture. What is the difference between charity and tzedakah?
The difference between charity and what?
And tzedakah. Tzedakah.
Oh, what does he want English?
Well, no, tzedakah is a little bit different than charity, as we'll see.
Righteousness.
Maybe righteousness. Okay, well, that's why we want to learn Peleoids, to try to answer that question. I'll just mention, by the way, when you talk about the power of the barriers, you know, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination that says, love your money, don't part with your money, there's a very famous story about the chief rabbi of Jerusalem way back 100 and so many years ago, almost 150 years ago, actually. His name was Rav Shmuel Salant. Mm-hmm. And they tell the story that in Jerusalem, people were like starving. I mean, the poverty back 150 years ago was incredible. And there was one Jew who actually had some money. I mean, I don't know what that meant at that time. I mean, I don't think he was a billionaire, but he had money. But he couldn't part with it. He was so stingy, he couldn't part with his money. And Rav Shmuel was approached by all the poor people, and they said, you got to do something for us. So Rav Shmuel says, there's nothing I can do. This man will not part with his money. But after all the pressure, Rav Shmuel decided he's going to get off his high horse and try whatever he could. So he came to see this rich person, and the rich person was so impressed that the chief rabbi of Jerusalem himself came to see him. And at the end of the conversation, when the rabbi described the situation of the poor people, they were literally freezing to death. They didn't have, you know, in those days they used to heat up the... How are you?
Can I drink?
Sure, please.
Kerosene, then.
Yeah, they had these campfires, and they put logs in it, but you had to pay for logs. You know, logs weren't free. So at the end of the conversation, the man was so touched that he turned to Rav Salanter and he said to him, Rebbe, I would like to give for the poor, but I can't do it. I just can't do it. So he took out the keys to the safe, and his hands were shaking. And he gave it to the rabbi. He said, Rabbi, you take the money. I can't give it to you. And that's how they supported the people. Could you imagine?
What's his name? Do you know?
No, the person, I don't know. This is a story of 150 years ago. I don't know if anyone knows today. But this is the legend they tell about Rav Shmuel Salan. He was the Rav of Yerushalayim. That's how he saved Jerusalem that year. You know, because he had the keys. But what I'm trying to explain to you is that it doesn't make any rational sense. It's a disease. You know how if a person suffers from, you know, we all suffer from various diseases. Everybody has their own peccal, as we say, you know. So this person, he couldn't get himself to give the money. But you take the keys, Rabbi.
But he gave it. He gave it.
But I'm just saying. You know? So that's how Reb Shmuel saved Jerusalem 150 years ago.
This is under Tzadi, right?
Yes. It's in my version.
No, but I only brought the first volume.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I want.
Maybe in the future.
I'll tell you the reason why I wanted to. The reason why I decided just an hour ago, 2 hours ago, to study this with you is because my goal is to combine this with the holiday of Pesach.
Oh.
Because I'm going to try to prove if we get a chance that the mitzvah of tzedakah has a special role with regard to Pesach. But let hold on, don't give away all my secrets here. Yeah, Roz is very advanced, so she gives away all my secrets. Okay. So he says the following. He says, Harezes socher charif shemal v'Hashem li'erech elef l'meah v'yoser uprima malolav yochel ba'olam hazeh. He says the following. If you have a sharp businessman, then he may lend money, and therefore he has to take money out of his pocket to offer a loan, to extend the loan. But what makes him a sharp businessman is that he's going to make a certain amount of profit on his money. He says the same way in his nimshal, you know, in this metaphor, if a person will give money for charity, again, I'm using the word charity in a general sense, for tzedakah, then his payment, he says, will be be'erech, he says, I would evaluate it as 1,000 to 100. That's 10 times the profit. And he says, if only we would be able to appreciate how much of a profit we're going to be making by giving this money. He says, ba'olam shekulo tov, in the world that's completely good, he means the world to come. He says, then ain't tzarech laharech bus. I wouldn't have to write this whole long chapter for you if we would somehow allow the perception of what the dividends would be if we would invest in charity, if you look at it from a business perspective, if that would penetrate into our heart and soul, and we would understand what we're getting, what's in store for us in the world to come, the world that's kulo tov, that's all good, I wouldn't even have to go into details. Ki lamafursamos enam tzrichin raya, for something that's famous, that's understandable, you don't need to bring any proofs. he says, but Yetzer Lev Adam, but the man, you know, man is living in a physical world with his own challenges, and that power from within, Mat'elo, confuses him and misguides him. Umaralo Rov Ma'od Machaneu, Rav Ma'od Machaneu, and instead what the Yetzer Hara shows him is, look at your wealth. You know, you don't want to part with your wealth. And therefore, he says, the Yetzer Hara sometimes tries to trick you, and he tells you that you're doing a mitzvah. Did you ever have that experience? Where the Yetzer Hara tells you what you're doing is a mitzvah. You know, it's bad enough if he tells you, well, you're tempted, you know, and he gives you a temptation. But then you know, what you're doing is not right. So you can see clearly the difference between good and evil. But sometimes the Yetzer Hara, he says, goes even further than that. And he pulls the wool over your eyes, and he convinces you that what you're doing is a mitzvah. So, for example, today, you know, I don't want to go into detail here, but about the politics of the country here, but today people defame the reputation of somebody else, and they do it for the sake of the mitzvah. You know, they'll tell you it's a great mitzvah what they're doing. You know what I mean? They're doing it for the sake of God. But you and I know. So, for example, you know, the founder of the Muslim movement was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He was a contemporary of the Peleoids. So he said that you can take a Sefer Torah, and you can kill someone with a Sefer Torah.
You bash him over the head, you mean?
You bash him over the head, for sure. It's very heavy. What was he trying to convey? That all for the sake of the Torah, you can kill somebody. He literally smashes his and defame him, you know.
He was the founder of which movement?
The Muslim movement. That's the ethic movement. The movement of ethics. You heard of it? The Muslim movement? No? Okay. Yeah, I gave a class here in this room once a week for a group of boys from Masa. I don't know if you heard of Masa. You know, they're all five of these guys are volunteering to teach English in various schools through this Masa movement. So we learned the Muslim movement together. Anyway, so what I wanted to tell you is that the Torah says that when at Har Sinai when the Torah was given, it says Ve'ra'u es ha-kolos. The pasuk says that you could see the voice of God. Now, why is it so important to see the voice of God? So the Vilna Gaon said the following. Listen to this very carefully. He says that the word lo, if you just hear it, has two spellings. You can either write it Lamed Vav, which means for him, or Lamed Aleph, which means no. So the Torah says, Lo Tigzol, you're not allowed to steal. Well, if you don't see it, all you do is hear it, you don't know what it means. Does it mean Lo Tigzol, don't steal? Or does it mean Lo, for his sake, you can steal? And what it means for his sake with a capital H is sometimes people will steal because of God. You know, they have the answer to. So therefore the Gaon says they had to see the voice. They had to see the Kol Hashem, that it was low with an Aleph, not low with a Vav. So that's what he's saying. The Yetzer Hara is going to tell you that you're doing a great mitzvah by not giving charity. How does he convince you of such? Well, after all, you have a family to support, right? And you want to leave a legacy, you know, you want to leave... hi, Larry, how are you? You want to leave an estate, you know, when you go. You don't want to leave your children without an estate. So that's called, in the Talmudic language, that's called Chayecha Kodmin. Okay, I'll try to translate that. The Gemara says the following, that two people are going in a desert. And one of them has water, right? He has how do you say it in English? A keton shalmayim, a flask.
Canteen.
A canteen of water, excellent. So the Gemara wants, so what do you do? Both individuals are dehydrating. And the sun is beating down hot. They're in a desert. And the Gemara says the following, that one of them could survive. And if let's say Reuven has the flask, he has the canteen, and if he drinks the water, Shimon is going to perish. If he gives the water to Shimon, then he himself will perish. So the Gemara quotes one opinion that says he split the water, and the Gemara doesn't really understand that. Well, why should he split the water? They're both going to perish. So perhaps they increase the chances of possibly getting to the Yishuv and surviving, maybe they'll get to the water. But Rabbi Akiva says, no, you have the water, you drink the water. Why do you drink the water? Because chayecha kodmin. What's chayecha kodmin mean? Your life.
You look at the numero uno.
Right, your life comes first, numero uno. So that's what the Yetzer Hara is going to tell you, that since the law says chayecha kodmin, why should you give away your money to someone else? Take it for yourself, because chayecha kodmin. And before you know it, he has you convinced. Now it's interesting, according to Chazal, at the end of time, God is going to kill the Yetzer Hara. In fact, you know, on the night of Pesach, we sing Chag Gadyah. You remember the Chag Gadyah? So at the end of the Chag Gadyah, the last piece in the whole domino theory is that God is going to come and he's going to slaughter the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death. The Malach HaMavis is actually the same as the Yetzer Hara, according to our rabbis. Now, why does he deserve to die? I mean, after all, he tempts you to sin. And that's exactly why God created him. He's also an angel of God, is he not? That we should have a freedom of choice. You with me on this?
Yeah.
So the answer is that although the Yetzer Hara is created by God, he has a certain mandate. And he can't cross the red line. He can convince you that you'll have a lot more fun if you do this and you violate the Avera, right? You know, there's this beautiful woman over there. You know, he's gonna get your passion. But what he's not allowed to do, he's not allowed to convince you that what the criminal act that you're about to implement is a mitzvah. And that's where he crosses all lines. And that's why eventually he's going to be slaughtered. Yeah. Do you remember the case of Esav? Who was older, Yaakov or Esav? Anybody remember?
Well, Yaakov was conceived first.
No, but I'm saying who was born first, I meant to say. Excellent. You're already more sophisticated. I'm just saying who was born first. So it says that Esav was born first. And Yaakov is holding on to the heel of Esav. You remember this? So later on, the Torah describes Esav as a personality, kitzayid befit. Very hard to translate that into English. Literally, it translates as catching animals or hunting is befit is in his mouth. So Rashi says, Tzayed Befiv means he knows how to capture you with his mouth. And he fools you. So he came to his father, Yitzchak, and he fooled him. He said to him, I'm a very pious person, and I want to know if I have to be mafrish truma from salt, from melach. You know, that we don't give truma from salt. Right? We don't. But he's more religious than the Pope, if you follow me. So that's how he fools Yaakov. Nothing against the Pope. But he also is a yarmulke, right? so that now Esav is an expert at fooling his father. He's fooling his father. Now Chazal tell us that every nation is symbolized by a certain animal. What's the animal that symbolizes Esav?
We read it last week, the chazir.
The chazir, right. And what's unique about the chazir, the pig?
Big patak is...
Excellent. It has split hooves.
The animal with split hooves doesn't chew.
But doesn't chew its cud. So on the outside, the pig presents himself as a kosher animal. Look, he waves his hooves in front of you. After all, I got split hooves. But on the inside, he's rotten to the core, so to speak, because he doesn't have the second simon of kashrus. And that's the problem. When the Yetzer Hara shows you, like, he's the big saint, you know, he's telling you what's tar and what's pure, when in fact it's just a fabrication. Do you remember a fellow by the name of Zimri? Anybody remember who he was?
Yeah, Zimri with
he was the prince of which Shevet? Let's see, I'm testing you here. Of Shimon, excellent. And he had a relationship with a woman from Moab. What was her name?
Cosby,
excellent. Cosby. So the Zohar says that when he had this relationship with Cosby, he actually believed that it was a mitzvah to have this relationship. And it was very important that he do it publicly and so forth and so on. So again, I'm not going to go into all the gory details about how he came to the conclusion that this relationship was a mitzvah, because she was the daughter of the prince. She was like the princess of Moab, and he felt that that was the way of getting Moab into Klal Yisrael, so to be part of the Jewish nation. It's like I have a friend of mine who went to a certain university, and that university was not a very positive environment for a religious Jew. I'm not going to go into all the details about what they do in that university. So anyway, so I asked him, why are you going to that university? He says to me, Bezalasha, he says, I want to be Makar of the Shiksas. Did you follow that? To be a Kiruv is, you know, a Kiruv movement is when you bring a Jew back closer. He says he wants to be Makare of the Shiksas. But he meant something else by that. He didn't mean to bring them closer to Yiddishkeit. But I, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So he made the Eitz HaHara look like a tzaddik. You know, I'm going to be Makare of the Shiksas. You know what I'm saying? That's what he said. Tell you, it's really wild. In any event, that's what's going on over here. So he says, this is what the Yetzer Hara says to the rich person. He says to him, why are you doing tzedakah for them? You should do tzedakah b'chaleis with banav, benosav. You have children, you have boys, you have girls, that younger children and older children, and therefore you should be supporting them. Now don't misunderstand the Peleoids. He's not telling you that a person shouldn't support his children. You know, today we live in a world in which the younger generation in the very Orthodox circles are dedicating their lives to Torah. It's an amazing thing that's going on. There's a yeshiva in Modi'in Elite. I don't know if you've heard of the place. It's right next to Modi'in. And it has 900 married men who are sitting and learning. It's an amazing sight. You can see that if you go online, you can see it. Just press in Modi'in Elite.
Do you believe in it?
900. 900 people. I don't know, but I want to know, what should the parents be doing? Should they be supporting their children or not?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying, you know, cut off your child. Yeah, you know, some people go very far. Like my mother, may she rest in peace, she said the following, Azaria, you want to sit and learn, that's fine, but don't collect food stamps. You collect food stamps, and that's it. We're finished. You know? She threatened me. You know, I had no intention of collecting food stamps, but there are plenty of places where, you know, Orthodox Jews are collecting food stamps, and that's like the bush of a cherub. There were two things my mother just couldn't tolerate. One is food stamps, and the other is that when you go down to get married, you know, you walk down the chuppah, that the fathers go with the chassan and the mothers go with the kallah. That she couldn't tolerate. She said, I'm not coming to your wedding unless I can bring you down to the
home. She gave birth to the person, to the child.
Yeah, but she forgot, unfortunately, at the end of her life, she suffered the last year from very bad
Alzheimer's
disease, or some sort of form, I don't know exactly. So I said to my mother, I said, Mom, you don't recognize me? So she said, you must have been an easy case. Meaning an easy birth. Now, there was one part of her brain, I think, that realized that, you know, something's fishy over here, that, you know, I was taking care of her head and foot, you know, who was I, just some gentleman, you know what I'm saying? But anyway, so that's what he says. You got to support your children, but even if you support your children, that's a great thing, but it doesn't mean that therefore you should turn your back on everyone else. Now, I want to tell you about one organization that my wife and I got involved. This is not a fundraiser, but I just want you to appreciate it. My wife and I, many, many years ago, got involved in an organization called Yad Eliezer. That's the name of it. They give out food packages, you know, a sal. How do you say in English, a sal?
Basket.
A basket, excellent. A basket of food, staples, once a month. To, I don't know how many families they're up to. When I was involved in Yad Eliezer, it was probably a couple hundred families. Today, I mean, it's a couple of thousands. Anyway, I was teaching in a seminary for women called Michlala, if you ever heard of it. So we were learning the laws of Bein Adam L'Chaviro, right? Social justice and all that. So on one occasion, I said, girls, you want to come to my house? Oh, they loved it. Come, we're going to go to the rabbi's house. So we went to the rabbi's house. And I invited Rabbi Wiesel. He's the founder of this organization, Yad Eliezer. It's just that they, you know, since we were learning the laws of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, they should get an idea of what kind of stuff he does. Anyway, there was a young lady in my class from the Syrian community. Now a lot of the Syrians are in New Jersey, but in those days, the Syrians were in Brooklyn. Now they're packing out to deal New Jersey. You know, they left a few Syrians back in Brooklyn. I'm just kidding. Anyway, so the Syrian community, if anybody knows, is very wealthy. You know, Baruch Hashem, B'li Ayin Hara. In Yiddish we say they made it in the shmata business, you know, that's what we say. I remember I was passing Shari Zion on Ocean Parkway, and there was a sign inside the, you know, inside the doors about the donors for the mikveh. They were building a new mikveh, right? So it went from $250,000 all the way down to $25,000. That was the lowest donation, $25,000. Anyway, so this girl, her father was not only a member of the Syrian community, but he was a lawyer that dealt with estates. He was an estate lawyer. So I want you to know that from that meeting of Rav Wiesel with my girls, these are girls of 17 years old, we got almost immediately we got $5,000 for Yad Eliezer, when the dollar was worth something. I'm talking, you know, and it was through her father because he was an estate lawyer. But that's nothing. That's not even the tip of the iceberg, because what happened is the Syrian community got involved in Yad Eliezer. Now that's unbelievable, because the Syrians give to their own charities. They don't like Ashkenazi charities. And Yad Eliezer is like an Ashkenazi kind of enterprise. And to this day, Yad Eliezer relies to a large extent on the Syrian community. And it all started in my living room. That's what I want to tell you. That's why I'm telling you the story. All right. Anyway, the Hinei Be'inyan Stoko on the second page, if you're following the text. Yesh Arachim. So what's Arachim? Arachim is what you call a system of priorities. In other words, one of the big issues in Stocker is how do you divvy up, how do you allocate the funds that you have? So he says, for example, one of the principles is Aniyei Ircha Kodman. You've heard of that? In other words, you support your local charities, you know, the people in your city. And he says that with regard to your own family, he says that's even on a higher level, and that's called Anshe Beso, and that's based on a pasuk called Mibsar Chaltis Alam. You know, don't ignore your own flesh and blood. So you have your own flesh and blood, then you have the Aniyim, the poor people in the city. And he says the following. He says, Bichlal Aniyei Ircha Hem Aniyei Eretz Yisrael. Listen to this. He says that there's a special status for the poor people in Israel. You know, in the old times, I'm going back centuries ago, they had what's called shluchim. Shluchim means that from Israel they would send out emissaries, you know, to collect charity for the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. And the Peleoitz is claiming that even though there was money that had to be collected and allocated for the local poor people, but nevertheless, there would be an obligation, a responsibility to redirect those funds towards the poor people in Eretz Yisrael. So the shluchim, these emissaries, would claim that they had special rights, so to speak, to demand or request charity money because they were representing the poor people in Israel. He says, L'chein nagu kol b'nei agola, the people all over the diaspora, litein l'shluchei Eretz Yisrael, to give to the people in Eretz Yisrael. Now let me ask you a question. The first question I'm hoping we'll get a unanimous answer on. Let's see if I'm right. The second question, maybe not. Is it a great thing to live in Israel from a halachic, from a Torah Jew perspective? Can we get a unanimous decision on that? Yeah. It's a great thing, right?
Yeah, we're here.
We're here. And that testifies to it. But now here's my second question. When you go to Eretz Yisrael, let's say you go on Aliyah, is it a great thing when your financial future is sort of in limbo? You don't really know. There's no one who can guarantee you that you'll be financially solid when you make Aliyah to live in Israel. So now I come back to my second question, which I think is a little bit more challenging. Is it a good idea, should we encourage people to make Aliyah, to live in Israel, no matter what? Even if we don't know, we're not sure, we don't have the security, no one can guarantee the future financial situation.
Nobody can guarantee the future financially anywhere you are.
Yep.
Great, job. But let's say I'm talking about a person. Listen to this, Ora.
Good job.
Exactly. He's doing quite well. Again, nobody guarantees what's going to bring tomorrow. But he's living a comfortable life. He's got a very solid income. When I say solid, I'm not talking about, you know, he invests in futures or he invests with Murdoch, Benzie schemes. I'm talking about a guy who has a guaranteed salary. No, nothing's guaranteed over, right? Nothing's guaranteed. He comes to Israel and, you know, with all due respect to all the organizations here and Rabbi Fass's organization, what's it called?
Nefesh B'Nefesh,
and the whole nine yards. But no one could really know what's going to happen here. He doesn't have a job. So what I want to show you here is the Pele Yoetz actually addresses this question. This you should have in your book. Under Eretz Yisrael.
What year did you write this?
2 centuries ago.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And he writes the following. He says, Mitzvah Gedola. It's a great mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. The Adua Ma'alosa Ki Rabba. And you know that the special, shall I say, level or status of living in Israel is Rabba. Rabba means it's absolutely stupendous. And he calls the land of Israel Makom Asher Bachar Bo Hashem. This is the place that God chose. And he goes on to say that if a person comes to live in Israel, then he fulfills what David HaMelech writes in Tehillim, Lachzos B'Noam Hashem Levaker Beicholo. He wants to be close to God. All this is in the land of Israel. Correct? So you can't question the Pele Yoetz's appreciation for the great mitzvah of living in Israel. Okay? I want to say that up front. But then he writes the following. He says, Yishtadel b'chol oz, he should try with every effort, with all his power, l'kvo dirato be'eretz Yisrael, to set up his domicile in the land of Israel. Rak, but listen to this. As soon as you see the rak, he's already, adding a proviso. He says, Yifkach einov tchila, he should first open up his eyes. And I guess you'd say, check out the land. Evaluate the situation. Shalolavo lios toe ala rishonos. Let me try to explain what I think he means. If you don't check out what's going to happen when you get to Israel, then you might come to the level called toe ala rishonos. Toe ala rishonos is a very bad thing. Toe ala rishonos means when you do a mitzvah and then you regret that you did a mitzvah. That's like that's thumbs down, to regret that you did a mitzvah. He says, because if he goes on Aliyah, he says, Shalolitz tarech lachzor v'latzeit, that he shouldn't put himself in the situation where he'll have to leave the land of Israel and go back. And he says, V'goder lezeh, the best thing that I would advise you, listen to this, in order to avoid such a situation, shalolelech el li'et zikna, he should only live in Israel when he's an older person. Li'achar shechadal mi'ios ish li'ishta orach kanoshim. Basically, let's call a spade, his wife is past menopause. That's what he said. V'ena yoledes, she can't give birth. And therefore, if his children are already mature, so he doesn't have the headache of raising his children in Israel. V'lo yolech imo yeladim bonim u'bonos. And he says, in such a case, Heina Emes, he says, I can't deny that Eretz Yisrael is a great atmosphere, and so forth and so on. Avol lefima she'inenu ro'os, what we see in front of our eyes, is that kashim mizonosim shel odim be'eretz Yisrael. In other words, he's basically testifying that there are people who made Aliyah, and we're seeing how difficult it is for them to make mizonot, meaning to have food to feed their family. Val harov, and in most cases what happens, hey mitzrachim latzeit, they have to leave the land. And not only that, sometimes they become shlichut. Shlichut means they go out to beg for charity. And they say, well, we live in Israel, and we have a special status of shluchei Eretz Yisrael, aniyei Eretz Yisrael. And he says, as a result, they're just collecting money. And he says that al rov him tzoch letzivin. Again, I'm just summarizing this because I want to get back to tzoch. He says chayei tzar yichyu. Very often they subject themselves to a life of enduring suffering. Heimu nishoseyem. He says they and their wives. He said yosameyem. Their wives suffer even more than they do. And he says rabba ros ovidrachim leguf lenefesh. As a result, it's pretty bad. And he says these are people who have kidei parnasasim bimkoma. They're doing well as far as parnasa back in the old country. But he says, if they go in their older age, kasher ya'ut, that's the appropriate time to go, and there they can live out in Israel, b'seva tova. By the way, older people come in Aliyah have it pretty rough too.
Yes.
Because they get pushed around on the buses, you know. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be the Rosh Kibahad. You could be the Gadol Ador. You get on the bus here, and you'll get pushed around just like anyone else. And he says, but for the most part, people who come in their older years, they're able to live b'seva tova. They can live out their life as very well. And he goes on in another paragraph to say that people are asking why you went on Aliyah, you settled in Eretz Yisrael, now you're collecting from us. He says people are going to say, who told you? Right? Umiranene and Oshi Basrayu. I'm skipping a few paragraphs, but he says Miranene. Miranene means that people are talking about him, not in a nice way. That's called Miranene. The MR, and they say the following: Mi bikesh zos mi echa. That's a pasuk in Yeshaya. He's quoting. Who asked you to do this? The Yachbidu al Acherim. And now you're making it difficult for us because we have to support you. Kidei shalelech liyartzo, because you want to live in Eretz Yisrael. Im ein lem mishalahem, if they can't support themselves, lo yelchlu, they shouldn't go. So again, as I told you, the first question was pretty unanimous, that everybody agrees that, living in Eretz Yisrael is a goal, and it's a great lofty ideal, and he doesn't deny that. He speaks the praises of the land of Israel. But he says, who tells you they have to go in order to impose yourself on others and collect charity? So I'm just mentioning this. Yeah, go ahead. What is your first name? I'm sorry. Richard.
Staying put, having a job, and supporting those who need it in Eretz Yisrael.
Right. That he would definitely advocate. But to advocate, settling in Eretz Yisrael in order that you should come back as a shliach and collect funds and panhandle, if you know the phrase, that he's not in favor of.
This what?
Panhandle.
Oh,
you know that phrase? Panhandle. Okay.
What about when your grandchildren call and they say, I'm collecting there's a leak in the roof in the yeshiva. I said, don't give me any stories. Every building has insurance. Well, whatever they
need. Ah, okay.
So how do you refuse that?
So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Disgusting. I said, they're making you.
Sometimes you see the healthiest person in the world and he comes to collect and you don't know what's going on. Like, why can't the guy take a job?
There's a guy I see basically every day at the old stop right outside the old city and collecting. And I saw him the other day at Ocean Rock. He's like, ah, you're at Tikka. And we kind of give a heads up. But I mean, I don't know. He's at Ocean Rock over here. I mean, somehow
he's able
to.
And he had a wagon full of food. Like, well, it was just
that I didn't see. Maybe he was.
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Maybe he was collecting there too.
Well, panhandlers in the U.S. are millionaires.
Really?
Sure.
That's also a disease. That's got to be a disease, right?
All day, half the lunch. How many people go by? And people give it $5, $10, $20.
Rich people. Yeah, I think it's a disease. I really do. But if a person is not diseased and they're normal, do they want to do a mitzvah at the expense of having to collect charity? And again, you can have any opinion you like. I'm just telling you what the Pelioid says. In my humble opinion, I think we have to find a little bit more of a compromise. And maybe, or you were hinting at this before, you should have a certain element of reliance on God, but at the same time, you got to do your homework. People who come and they haven't done a stitch of work, and somebody convinced them they have to get on the next plane. Look, it's true. Some people, I'm not sure. There's a phrase called Avas Mordechai and Sinas Haman. We love Mordechai and we don't like Haman. Like, so there are different categories of people who make Aliyah. Some people make Aliyah because of Avas Mordechai. Other people make Aliyah because of Sinas Haman. And what happens is they lose their job. Or there's anti-Semitism, they get into a situation. Today in France, for example, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, all of Europe, but France in particular. Now, I don't know the statistics today, but maybe about 10 years ago, there were 750,000 Jews in France. And that's the largest Jewish population in Europe, is in France. And not just in Paris, in a number of different cities. Now, I'm not saying that every last French Jew is on the next plane to make Aliyah, but hopefully the situation won't get worse. There are quite a few French Jews coming now. What's going to be later on, I don't know. I'm not a prophet. But that's what I call making Aliyah out of Sinas Haman. So, you know, if you have to come, you have to come. You know, you don't want to expose yourself to, you know, to constant threats and dangers. So, you know, I always think maybe God gave us the state of Israel because, you know, if the situation gets really bad, you know, where can we go? Where does a Jew go? Yeah, I don't want to tell you what I, again, this is my feeling about the Democratic Party in America. I don't know if you're up on it. The five candidates for the Democratic Party for the United States of America, there's only one thing that binds them together, and that is the hatred for Israel. It's unbelievable. You know, I used to vote Democrat. Finally, I got smart. But you can vote whatever you like. I don't care. Anyway, what?
Problem in the U.S. now is that it's becoming, anti-Semitism is coming there too.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. And it's not good. I have a member of my family. She told me I'm packing my bags. She has a beautiful home in Brooklyn. Beautiful home. Most homes in Brooklyn are not beautiful, but ours is beautiful. I mean, it's right off Manhattan Beach, if you know. And she said, I'm packing out. I can't take what's going on in America. There's a woman who wrote an article in Mishpacha magazine. Not an article, a letter to the editor. She's one of the few Orthodox people in Lakewood, New Jersey that doesn't own a car. That's very rare. So she travels in public with public transportation. And she starts describing what she hears on the bus. It's frightening. It'll make your hair stand on end. It's crazy. You know, I lived in New York for 25 years. One time in my life I had an anti-Semitic incident. I was trying to back into a parking spot. Okay, maybe it took me a little time. You know, I wasn't so proficient. You know, when you back into a spot. So this woman goes by, rolls down a window, and yells out, "Dirty Jew." I'm like, what did I do to her? I was just, you know, trying to get into a parking spot. But this was many, many years ago. But again, I'm not saying that I naively believe that all the goyim love us, but I didn't sense
it. It was very latent. In other words, they could have had these feelings, but they didn't express them openly.
Right. Now there's a cause, you know, the BDS and all that stuff, so there's a cause. And the worst hotbeds of anti-Semitism are now the campuses all over the United States. It's like all over. The worst, I heard, according to what I heard, the worst are Columbia and NYU. It's unbelievable.
One of the problems is it's always been there.
Always been there, right.
Under the surface. It's been accused of being on the far right, but now it's on the far left.
Right.
And it's become acceptable on the far left by the left.
Right.
And a lot of the progressive liberal Jews on the left say that their process is tikkun olam based on Jewish, but that's not Judaism. Mm-hmm. And they tolerate it, and they don't, you know, they don't fight that because they have this I forget what they call it, but it ties into all the other progressive ideas. You know, if you're going to be a progressive, so you're tolerating a little anti-Semitism. You know, they call free speech.
I see.
But if you want to be, you know, pro-choice and pro-this. All right, so you're pro free speech, and who's anti-Semitism? So what? Right. And that's become normal.
Yeah. So again, he has this hierarchy of giving tzedakah and what comes first and how to allocate your funds. And he says the following. He says that kishenotein le'aniei iro, we said that the local poor people have a special, you know, priority. But he says the following. Tzarich la'avchin, he has to distinguish, eza ani hagun tzanua ma'ale v'choshev ben tovim. He says the following. If he has a limited amount of funds and he wants to divvy them up amongst the people in his city, he should try to give for a good cause. Good people. And he says that what he has to seek out is someone who's hagun tsanua umale. Now, it's very hard to describe these words They're very subtle and very different one from the other, but only subtle differences. And basically what he says, this is the word tsanua, means a modest person. There are a lot of people who, when they come to collect money, they're sort of bold about it. They're brazen about it. They think it's coming to them. You know what I mean? They put it all on the outside. You know, number uno, right? That kind of idea. He says, look for someone who's tsanua. Now, that's not easy to find, someone who's modest, because the modest people are not banging down your doors.
These are the people who come to New Jersey from New York on Sunday morning with their pamphlets waving, and they're soliciting out of town. With, like, they're not modest about it.
They're not modest, right. So he's advocating, try to, again, I don't know, he doesn't give you the step-by-step process, but he's saying, if you can, then you should try to single out or try to identify the modest people. Lahem yiftach yado biyosef. For them, he should open his hand as much as he possibly can, and therefore yigdal erka shal tzedaka. It upgrades the level and the value of his charity. Val kolpanim lo yifchod militein lechol shol lechol min on. He says, nevertheless, try to give at least a minimum, very bare minimum, to every ani if you can. Kibidat kono. And he says, in that way you're imitating God. So this is very interesting. I'll read to you the next line, but he's trying to present the thesis that we have, generally speaking, two categories of mitzvot. We have Bein Adam L'Makom, we have Bein Adam L'Chaver. Between man and God, man and man. So where would you place charity? Between man and man, correct? He's saying, no, it's more than that. It's imitating God. We are brought here, imitatio Deo, to imitate God. And he says that, look at the pasuk that we say every three times a day in Ashrei. It says, Posech yodech, umazbir l'chol chai ratzon, and rachmav al kol ma'asav. There's an extra word here, kol ma'asav. God has compassion on every one of his creatures. So God makes sure that every one of the creatures are cared for, are given the possibility of sustenance. And therefore he says, let's imitate God and introduce Rachmav al kol ma'asav on all creatures. So that even though you have a system of priorities, but nevertheless you should still try to guarantee that you give to every single person.
Does that include animals?
Maybe even animals. Animals comes not under tzedakah, but under what's called tzar bali chayim, which means that we have to feel and identify with the suffering of animals. And that's how we pass. And he says the following. What do we do in a case of a person who comes to solicit and he's an avaryan, he's a sinner? He says, where is it? Sorry, I lost the place here. He says, Umasha Amru, he quotes a Gemara, Hachshilem Bivnei Adam She'enam Mehuganim. He says the following. Sometimes you are swindled, if I could use that word, by people who really don't, you know, they're not proper people. They don't deserve your tzedakah. He says, Efshar Dahainu She'enam Tzrichim Litol Parnasosam. And he says, "V'notlim lahotzi lidvar avera." These are people who don't need money to support themselves. They need money for the sake of evil. They want to, you know, use that money for bad things. Does anybody have in mind anything that comes to your mind? People who, what do you have in mind? I mean, I wonder if you're thinking about the same thing I'm thinking about.
Drug addict.
Excellent. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. He says, note, if you have reason to believe that a person is collecting for food, ain't bodkim. So that's another priority here. Give priority to someone who needs food. That's number one, because basically his life is at stake. It's almost like a life-threatening situation. He says, v'chein erech atztok lefi machsoro. But he says that you can go beyond just giving this basic charity for sustenance, And that's called Lefi Machsoro. Is anyone familiar with that phrase, Lefi Machsoro? Lefi Machsoro means that the person was used to a certain standard of living. Like in the Gemara's time, they give the example, again, we'll have to make it into more contemporary, but he has a horse. He owns his own horse. A horse is a big thing, you know, in those days. Today, I think also a horse is probably expensive. How much do you pay for a horse today? I mean, a good horse.
You know which horse you're buying.
Yeah, it probably fluctuates from, I don't know what to what.
Thousands,
I
mean, to millions.
Thousands to millions.
Hundreds to millions.
Yeah.
Well, today would be the equivalent of owning a Mercedes versus owning a Thai, a little jalopy.
Right, right, for an automobile. So imagine the case of a person who was used to all his life, he was used to a nice car. I don't want to say, you know, he had a, you know, a Volvo, you know, I don't know, I'm outdating myself here. What's it called, the Italian car?
Ferrari?
A Ferrari, yeah. I'm not saying he drove a Ferrari for all his life, you know, and he spent $100,000. But he had a decent car, and now he's so poor, he can't even afford a car. So that, he says, is called De Machsoro. If you can chip in, and I'm not expecting you to buy him a car, but you can chip in. He says Vitsaro, because he's suffering. Then he says the higher level is Pidyon Shvuyin, which means to free a captive. Right? You redeem a captive. He says that's Kodem, that comes even first, it's greater than even Parnasat Aniyim, than even supporting the poor people. V'ein mitzvah rava, there's no greater mitzvah gedola ke Pidyon Shvuyin. Like being Polish for you. When I was a youngster, I remember there was a famous Jew, I know his name, I'm not going to mention it right now, you can ask me about it later, but he was hostage. He was taken hostage. They were asking for $1 million of ransom at a time when $1 million was worth probably $20 million today. And we went out to the community to try to raise the money. At the end, the police actually were able to locate where they were hiding. And they were able to free him. He's Baruch Hashem. He's not alive anymore, but he lived to an older age. He says that in general, Yarech. What time is it? I just don't want to. Okay, we have another 5 minutes. He says Yarech Adam Adochak Vatzar Shalani. He says what's important is not just to give a cold coin, as we would say, but Yerachim Olav. He should empathize with the Ani, and he says that those feelings of empathy will be rewarded from heaven. That when he gets into Nebuchadnezzar's situation where he needs divine compassion, he too, like he had compassion for someone else, will be able to have compassion. Ulefi said, therefore, ha'erech bizman erech kigon bi'arve yomim tovim. He says it's especially, and that's why I wanted to cover this topic, it's especially important and significant to give money to a family in need before Yom Tov. And he gives another example of Nisuin, before they marry off a child, She'oz ha'otza'a meruba, that before Yom Tov and before marrying off a child, the expenses are quite high, and therefore it's almost like Pidyon Shvuyim, it's almost like redeeming someone who's captive, because if you can't afford the Yom Tov, you're like incarcerated. Now, he doesn't mention this here, but I wanted to point out that when it comes to Pesach, this is a very important principle. Now again, one reason for that is that the prices are sky high. Shmura matzah, you know, is pretty expensive.
That's what's called lechem oni.
Lechem oni, right. If you're not an oni, you become an oni, you become a poor person. Now, I have a particular problem because I only eat spelt. So spelt matzah is like they double the price. I don't know. And I have two grandchildren who are celiac. So you have to eat gluten-free matzah. Now, there's no such thing as gluten-free matzah, but there's low-gluten matzah that's oats, and it comes from England. And it costs like, I don't know how much. You know, you go into...
You know, there's a place by the shuk that sells gluten-free matzah.
Yeah. Is it the England? Is it coming from England? Or maybe there's a new. Maybe this year is something new. Can you check it out for me, Ari?
Yeah.
Because last year they had to import it from England. It was like there's one farm in England that's growing oats that's almost gluten free. You know, 90.
It was 60 shekels a box, and it tastes as good as it sounds.
Yeah. It's pretty big.
Yeah.
But 60 shekel a box is not as bad as what they paid last year. So it might be. Check it out for me.
All right, well,
anyway, so what I want to tell you is the following. We have a special mitzvah before Pesach. What's it called? Maos Chitin or Kimcha de Pisco. We collect money for matzah. Now here I want to share with you two things. First of all, I want to tell you my father in his youth was in a little shtetl called Plisa. That's where he was born until he was almost bar mitzvah age in Lithuania. And he said that when his grandfather would get up and raise, you know, the funds for Kimcha de Pisco, he would say, I'll tell you what he said in Yiddish and then I'll translate it to English. He said there are two choices, Adam a gift, Adam a nebt. Either you give or you take. There's no middle ground. But what I really wanted to tell you is the Vilna Gaon has an unbelievable insight. He says that when the Torah says to eat matzah, it doesn't say tochal matzah, but it says matzos te ochel. Now the difference is you have to know Hebrew grammar, but one is active and one is causative. So te ochel means, literally translated to English, the matzah should be eaten. So the Gaon wants to know, why did the Torah use that strange syntax? Why say the matzah should be eaten? The Torah should say eat matzah. And he says the following, that you have to guarantee that some other Jew can eat matzah. That's called te achel. It should be eaten. And he says if you don't guarantee that he can eat matzah, again assuming you have the wherewithal to do so, then you don't fulfill your mitzvah of matzah. That was the incredible chiddush of the Gaon. So I just wanted to choose this particular topic for tonight of the Peleoids of Tztaka because I thought it's a way of getting us in the mood for Yontif. And I want to thank everyone for joining me tonight. Anyone who wants to stay for Chumash, we'll start in about, let's see, I'd say about 3-4 minutes. Okay then? Get yourself a tea and a coffee, and thanks again for joining us.
You know how you said that if you do it for granted, it's a problem?
Yeah.
So. What if you didn't do an Avera, but you regret not doing the Avera? Right?
That's really the Yitzhar is getting the best of you, that you regret that you didn't do an Avera. The Yitzhar is probably convincing you that you know, you should go back and retrace your steps and do the Avera. Get it right this time. That's what he's telling you.
You speak Yiddish?
A little bit. A job.
Can you read Yiddish?
Reading is hard for me. I mean, I can break my teeth, and if I'm... See, the problem is that written Yiddish uses the real Yiddish. You know, the Yiddish that I know is sort of like the colloquial, you know, the real Yiddish has these complicated words. They're probably German. They're not even Yiddish. And it's just endless. You could have like 17 syllables, you know.
I wrote a letter that I found my mother's papers from my father in script. That's at least close to 100 years old. I'm trying to get
so I would say that my older brother is a better addressed than I am. You know, he actually studied in the yeshiva where they taught Yiddish. So his Yiddish is better than mine. For my father, it would be a cinch because that was his first language was Yiddish. But I'm going to New York for Pesach. My in-laws both, you know, their language is Yiddish. My mother actually speaks many languages. My mother-in-law, I mean. And my father also speaks many languages, but Yiddish is their, what we call their mamalush, and that's their...
I sent it to some people in New York, they wanted $175, $200 for translation.
Well, how long of a text is it?
It's just two pages.
Two pages.
Short page.
Look, I can ask my in-laws, they're not going to charge you anything, that I can promise you.
I sent it to Rabbi Meyer, he's going to look around. But it goes back to a letter from my great-great-grandmother to my great-grandfather. It's a bunch of like, I know, and it says partially.
You know, from a father to a daughter, or what?
My mother to her son.
To a mother to a son.
My great-grandfather died in 1936, so certainly before then. And some people said, you know, it's just you know, Shabbat, from Parsha, Ki Tisa, and from his mother to Baruch, which is my great-grandfather's Hebrew name, Esed. So either...
That's what you have so far in translation.
That's the only thing I can recognize. Right. So I'm wondering if it's either something about either prayers to someone who's sick, or it's a shopping list. But I have a copy of it, and see if I can get it translated.
All right, so again, if you want, I could ask my in-law.